The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on this Friday morning. I'm Brent Noctegal and I'm filling in for Stephen Flurry. Today we're coming live to you from the Edstone campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College in England. As many of you know, I'm normally stationed with my wife in Jerusalem, but we left Jerusalem, funny enough, to celebrate the Passover and the days of unleavened bread up here. And it was kind of strange yesterday. Or 2 days ago, flying out of Tel Aviv Airport, and when a lot of people are coming in at this time of the year, obviously many Jews from around the world, and even some Christians as well, coming to the holy city to celebrate and the Days of Unleavened Bread and Pesach, as the Jews call it. But even though I'm not in Jerusalem today, but over here in England, I still want to talk about Jerusalem. As many of you know, last night was the Passover, and today is Passover Day. And it was about this time that, if you're listening to this live, time of day right now, about 3 p.m. Jerusalem time, that Jesus finally said, "It is finished." His earthly work was complete. He had just sustained the most horrific bodily injuries of any man, leading to the most horrific death of any man. And now, with this event fresh on our minds, and on your minds, given the Passover memorial service last night, I want to dig just a little bit deeper into that history to fill in some of the background to that event, some of the political affairs of the city of Jerusalem and the land of Judea. Now, I'm an instructor as well at Herbert W. Armstrong College, and I get to teach a class on the history of ancient Israel, which looks at the history in the Bible in the world in which it was written. And it's a really exciting class to me because you can fill in the backstory to these biblical events. And when you do that, that's when the history of these events comes to life. So for today's show, I asked Stephen Flurry if he wouldn't mind if I went back to this period of when the gospel was written, to the time of Jesus Christ, the time of the Roman Empire, the time of kings, of Caesars. And it's hoped that as we do this, the Bible will come more alive to you, this history of what took place last night, and even the history of the Gospels themselves will become more alive. These are real events that happened to real people in the course of history. Now, Jesus, of course, he was a real man. He was born, he grew up, he lived, he worked, he conducted his ministry, and then he died in a definite place, in a definite time in history. Now, it's important to remember, though, at the outset here, that the political situation that Christ was born into was actually different in that which he lived most of his life. You see, when Christ was born in about 4 BC, the famous leader of the Jews was Herod, Herod the Great. He reigned over the territory of Judah, which is basically similar size to what Israel is today. And this man, Herod, he was a brilliant, yet somewhat paranoid man, and he was allowed to rule over Judea as a client king of the Roman Empire. He ruled by the good graces of Rome, basically, but he was given a lot of autonomy to decide how events in Judea would go and happen, and how the place was ruled. As long as the Romans could see that Herod ensured that there was rule and law of order in Judea, and that they paid their taxes, then he was allowed to rule. Now, he ruled over that territory from 37 BC to 4 BC, the very year Christ was born, as I said earlier. And he was brilliant in a lot of different ways. He constructed some amazing projects on the coast of the Mediterranean. He built a Roman-style port city named Caesarea Maritima, and that was the gateway for anyone that wanted to visit Judea. And you can go there today and look at the amazing archaeological ruins from 2,000 years ago, the amazing port that he built, the self-dredging port, the place where concrete, it looks like, was one of the places where concrete was first used underwater by Herod. He also built his multi-layered palace in Masada at the edge of the Dead Sea. Jerusalem gets a little bit cold in the winter, and he decided that he was going to construct this magnificent palace overlooking the Dead Sea to retreat from those cool winters. And then the most famous thing that he built, obviously, was the refurbishment, the upgrading of the Second Temple there in Jerusalem. So his ability to build was really second to none, even throughout the Roman Empire. But as I said earlier, he was a little paranoid as well, because he always feared that somebody was going to take over his rule. He killed brothers, mothers, wives, sons as well, and really any political opponent that he thought threatened his rule. He would simply wipe them out. Of Augustus Caesar at the time, he said that he would rather be one of Herod's pigs than his sons, because it was more likely that you would survive. Now, it was at the very end of Herod the Great's life that Jesus Christ was born, which is why when we read about his birth, that is Jesus' birth, we hear about Herod assembling a group of Jewish scribes to find out where this prophesied king, where this prophesied ruler was to come from. And when he hears, when the paranoid Herod the Great hears that the answer is Bethlehem, the ruthless king kills all babies two and under from the town to prevent another potential rival to his rule. Now, this was par for the course for Herod the Great. He'd been doing this, knocking off potential rivals for years. And while Jesus was obviously still a baby at this time, his paranoid leadership led to the death of a lot of little children. Now, Jesus Christ obviously escaped that. He was sent down to Egypt for a time to escape that wrath of Herod. And then soon after he was sent, Herod the Great died. So there was a situation in Judea up until Christ was born where we had this one king that ruled over the whole territory. And that changed when he died. When he died, he had a number of sons, and the area of Judea was divided up into smaller areas, and three of which were ruled over by Herod, Herod, and Herod. They loved their name. So all his sons were also named Herod. But in the Bible, when you see the word Herod, it could be a number of different people. So the different sons that ruled over different territories, we had Herod Antipas. He is the Herod that is mostly referred to in the Gospels. He ruled over the territory of Galilee, which is just in the western area of the Sea of Galilee, as well as the region of Perea, which was just on the other side of the Jordan River, where John the Baptist did a lot of his ministry. So that was kind of where Jordan is today. That's Herod Antipas. One of the other sons was Herod Philip, and he ruled over the territory of Golanitis, and that's where the Golan Heights is today. And then another son, Herod Archelaus, he ruled over the territory of Judea and Samaria, most of the coastal plain, including Jerusalem itself. Now, this man, Archelaus, he got the largest territory of Herod's. And out of all the sons, he was most like his father, Herod the Great. However, he was so upset a lot of the time. He took his wrath out on the Jews quite a lot that the Jews themselves got upset. And the Jewish people got upset with the way that Archelaus ruled, and there was fear amongst the Romans that there would be some type of insurrection of the Jews against the established leadership in Judea and Samaria, in this area, which we'll call Judea, which is this territory that Archelaus held. Now, there were two pretty important political religious factions that no doubt you know about. If you've read through the gospel accounts, we have the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and they came together and they petitioned the Roman government that they would get rid of Archelaus because of the way that he was ruling. And the Roman government, again, wanting order, they agreed to these terms. But instead of another Herod coming into power over this territory of Judea, or another kind of client king of some sort ruling over this territory, the Romans decided to do something different. So this happened in 6 AD. He had about 10 years of rule after Herod the Great died, Archelaus did. And then he himself was removed. And the Romans, because of this area was so important to them, this area of Judea and Jerusalem to be over the Jews, where most of the Jews lived, they made it a Roman imperial province. Now, we're going through this history just because it has everything to do with how the night of Jesus Christ's death went and the decisions that were made. It was very important that this territory was made a Roman imperial province and wouldn't be under direct Jewish rule because of a lot of the prophecies that were going to have to take place for Jesus Christ to be killed in a certain way. Now, so while this territory, before this territory of Archelaus belonged to the sons of Herod, and there was a lot of autonomy from the Romans without a direct Roman overseer, that all changed now when they made it an imperial province. In the Roman Empire, you had two types of provinces, as you probably know. The majority were ones that were controlled by the Senate, and others, imperial provinces like Judea, was directly ruled by Caesar himself. These were mostly unstable provinces. They needed more direct oversight, where decisions could be made swiftly and energetically to prevent disorder. The Romans, again, they loved order and they wanted to ensure that that prevailed, and they used whatever means was necessary. Now, given that Judea, again, was on the very eastern part of the Roman Empire, the Parthian Empire was growing out of Mesopotamia and pushing right up against to Judea, Caesar decided that was important, that he had a lot of control over this territory once Archelaus was removed. But of course, Caesar isn't going to come and rule the province himself. He would send a trustworthy intermediary, a procurator, as they were called, a governor of sorts, who would ensure that the native population didn't rebel. Now, the procurator that is most famously known in the Bible is, of course, Pontius Pilate. So from the year 6 AD, when Archelaus was removed, till about 40 AD, the very years that Christ would grow up and fulfill his ministry, Judea would be ruled over by a procurator or the governor of the Romans, while the area of Galilee and Golanitis would remain under the rule of Herod Antipas and Herod Philip. But while the procurator himself, he ruled from Caesarea, was the final court of appeals for the Jews, and if there was cases involving treason against the Roman Empire, or if a Roman citizen was being tried by the Jews, that's the only times that he would really interfere in the daily affairs of the Jews. He didn't want to do too much of the governing, this procurator. He left that to the Jews mostly themselves. The Jews themselves in this area of Judea had a pretty effective system of government when this procurator came into power for managing the day-to-day affairs, of course. They already had their law, their biblical law as well. And so he didn't really interfere too much in the day-to-day running of the state. At the top of this Jewish government in Judea was, of course, the high priest, and he acted as that intermediary between the procurator and the Jewish people. And it seems, though, during the period of the procurators that the high priest himself, he was kind of a puppet of the Roman Empire because the Roman Empire didn't want one of these high priests to get too powerful. So if the procurator thought that he was too powerful, he would remove him and elect somebody else or install somebody else. But underneath this high priest was the Jewish legislature, the Jewish court, and that was known as the Sanhedrin. And that was run essentially by two parties, and they have different religious beliefs. The Sadducees, who were mainly made up of priests, people of priestly descent, they formed what was essentially the high positions of this Sanhedrin. They were the cabinet ministers of the government. They were closest to the high priest, as the high priest was generally a Sadducee. These Sadducees had the power within the Jewish government under, of course, the procurator. And then there were the Pharisees, and we all know about them as they're mentioned in the Gospels and how they would confront Jesus Christ a lot. They condemned him a lot because he wouldn't teach his disciples to follow after the traditions of the elders, as they were called. So you had the Pharisaical group as well, the main religious authority in Judea. But there was also another political group, or rather, it could be called a movement, at the time of Judea as well, that made the political situation somewhat tense during Christ's life and thereafter. This political group or movement was known as the Zealots. And they believed that the Roman government should be removed from Judea completely. They went as far as to try and arm themselves to form an insurrection against the Romans. And later, after Christ's death, it would be members from this group that would lead the rebellion against the Roman government, which eventually led to the Roman armies of Vespasian and Titus in 70 AD to try and to come and conquer the Jews. However, you won't really see this name Zealot mentioned too much in the Bible. We know that one of Christ's disciples was Simon Zelotes. He belonged to this movement. But other than that, there's not too much of this word written. Josephus fills us in to let us know that this was the name of the movement. Instead, in the Gospels, what we see are the terms thief or robber. And these were euphemistic terms that applied to the Zealots. See, in order for the Zealots to raise enough money to pay their soldiers or to try and rebel against the Roman Empire, they had to rob, extort, blackmail a lot of the rich Jews. And it was largely known throughout Judea, in this area of Israel, as it would become to know, that most of these Zealots came from the area of Galilee, the place, the exact place that Christ would grow up and conduct most of his earthly ministry. So now, just to recap what we've covered so far, when we get to the time of Christ's trial and death, again, what took place last night, we have Judea ruled by a Roman procurator, and underneath him, the Jewish high priest and legislature made up of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We also have this group known as the Zealots, that grew up or began in Judea, in the Galilee, and wanted to rebel against the Roman Empire. And then we also had, in those territories of Galilee and Golanitis, two sons of Herod still ruling, Herod Antipas and Herod Philip, that had a lot of autonomy separate from this Jewish territory governed by the procurator known as Judea. Now, with this stage set, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to see how all these political factors converge on the last day of Jesus Christ's life. If you want to grab your Bible, I would, because equipped with these knowledge, I'm really hoping that some scriptures that you've read a lot are going to come to life in ways that they haven't done before. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means city of peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, This is the Trumpet Daily Program.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm Brent Nuchtigall, again filling in for Stephen Flurry. And before the break, we were discussing the political situation that existed in Judea, especially around or leading up to the time of Jesus Christ's life. Now we're going to cover a few scriptures from the final night of Christ's life in the context of what we covered earlier. And let's just watch how these scriptures come to life. Now, the first event we're going to talk about is the arrest of Jesus Christ. It's important to know that this happened in the middle of the night after they had already taken off the Passover and they went into the Garden of Gethsemane, as we know, and there Christ spent a lot of the time praying, trying to get the or allow God to provide him with the strength to go through with what he knew was prophesied to happen later that night and then the next day, the same day that we are living in today, about 2,000 years ago. Now, if you want, you can grab your Bible, as I said, and we'll go through a couple of these scriptures. The first one's over in Luke chapter 22 and verse 52. So this is early in the morning, maybe around 2 a.m. or something like that when this is taking place. We've had Judas that has betrayed Christ at this point. He's gone to get certain people to come and arrest Christ. But let's read verse 52. So this is once he is about to be arrested. He says, "Then Jesus said unto the chief priests and the captain of the temple and the elders which were come to him, Be you come out as against a thief with swords and staves?" So let's put this together with what we already know and see who is responsible for the arrest of Christ at this time and why he was arrested. Now, in Luke's account, it talks about the chief priests being the ones that were coming out to arrest Christ, as well as this, as we've just covered. Who were these chief priests? The chief priests were associated with the Sadducean leadership. This wasn't necessarily the Pharisees, although they were in on this, obviously, as we'll see. Who came out? We had the captain of the temple guard. He was to ensure that nobody, not the Jews, would get whipped up in a religious fervor during the holiday season and try and start an insurrection against the Romans. So who came? There were Roman soldiers as well as the Sadducean leadership. And Christ says to them, "Are you come out against a thief?" Now, again, we covered what this term meant. This isn't just talking about somebody that stole a few things. This is talking about somebody that is a member of this zealotry movement. They said, Christ asked, "Do you come up out against me and arrest me like I'm a zealot, somebody that's trying to overthrow the Roman Empire?" And again, that's why we see the Roman soldiers there trying to see whether this was an insurrection against the Roman Empire. These people were in the habit of arresting zealots in this manner, the Jewish leadership as well as the Roman soldiers coming out and to arrest people that wanted to rebel against the Romans. And they obviously classified Jesus Christ as a zealot as well. They knew he was from Galilee. He fit the picture. People were following him. So the Romans kind of bought into this. And they thought, and Jesus Christ correctly analyzed the situation and asked, "Do you think I'm one of those people that are trying to lead a rebellion against the Roman Empire?" Now, from here, he doesn't come toward to Pontius Pilate at this time. Jesus, of course, accepts the arrest or goes with them. And if you want, we can go over to John chapter 18 and verse 12 and 13 to read the next scriptures. Again, they weren't just arresting somebody willy-nilly for, you know, stealing something. This was a euphemism for this zealotry movement. Verse 12, chapter 18, and John chapter 18 and verse 12, it says, "Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus, and they bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year." So notice they don't go to the Roman government first of all. It was the Sadducean leadership that had arrested him along with Roman soldiers, the captain of the temple guard, and they go directly to this man named Annas. Now, who was Annas? He wasn't the high priest, where we see in that verse that the high priest that year was Caiaphas, his son-in-law. This man, Annas, was probably one of the most powerful men in Judea throughout the time of Jesus Christ's upbringing and ministry. He was the original high priest from about 6 AD through till 15 AD when he was removed. Yet all the sons, or all the high priests, sorry, from after Annas onwards were a relation of some sort to him. And so while the Romans had installed a new high priest, that is Caiaphas, and you can see even the language here of the book of John that he doesn't have much respect for that, saying that he was the high priest that year, like the high priest, priestly office does change according to whoever the Romans want at that time. And yet they still bring him to the patriarch of the high priest, that is Annas. Now in verse 14, there is a parenthetical statement that that John tries to link up a previous story of something that took place a week earlier, linking this man Caiaphas. I'll just read verse 13 and 14 again. It said, "And they brought him to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people." Now, let's not, you know, think that he's thinking that what we think when we read one man dying for the people, in the sense that this was the Son of God that had the power to, if he was killed and lived a perfect life, could be that ransom for everyone that ever lived coming from him if they accept those conditions. No, that's not what Caiaphas was talking about. Let's go back to John chapter 11, and we'll see what he's talking about when it refers to this man Caiaphas, and what he said when he said that it was beneficial for one man to die. This is John chapter 11, verse 47 and verse through to verse 50. Now, this passage of scripture is critical to know why the political establishment wanted to silence and kill Jesus Christ. In fact, it was the time at which they decided that it had to be done. Lazarus had just been resurrected. This was a man that was dead, was known to the people in Judea, was dead for a number of days. Jesus Christ came, resurrected him, and he was seen by the public. And people were going around to Lazarus's house to see this man that they knew had died. And word got back to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and they were worried that the movement that was following Jesus Christ by the regular people seeing the miracles was going to bring the Roman government down on them. Here we are in John chapter 11, just after Lazarus is resurrected. Verse 47, "Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council." So this is the Sanhedrin. We've got the chief priests. It doesn't say Sadducees, but it says the chief priests, which we know are made up of the Sadduceical body. "And the Pharisees a council and said, 'What do we? For this man does many miracles. And if we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him. And if that happens, the Romans shall come and take away both our place and our nation.'" Do we realize what's going on here? If this leader, Jesus, is popular with the people, and the Romans see this groundswell of movement, they are going to be worried that we're starting to rebel against their empire. And they're going to come away and they're going to take away our positions of authority. The Sadducees, the Pharisees that were part of the legislative body that ruled underneath the Roman procurator, underneath the high priest, they were worried of their petty positions being lost if they failed to do their job, which was to keep down Jewish rebellion, to keep the status quo, to keep order. So then one of them, this is verse 49, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that year, said unto them, "You know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, that the whole nation perish not." If the masses began to believe that Christ was the Messiah, as many of them did, they would mount an insurrection against the Romans, even if it wasn't called on by Jesus Christ. And the Romans, they would blame it on the Jewish leadership. They would take away their official positions. And they were concerned about this. And it's in that context that Caiaphas, the high priest that year, tells them, what are you worrying about? We only have one reason to worry, and that's if we do nothing. Instead, he told them we have to act. Better this one man, even if he is innocent, better he loses his life than the rest of us get taken captive, the rest of the Jewish people, according to them, or better than our positions being taken away. So from this point on, as even the scriptures tell us, they try and find out a way to put Jesus Christ to death. But they've got a problem. How do you convict a perfect man? How do you convict a man that hasn't broken Caesar's law? How do you do that? How do you put him to death? Well, from here, from Annas, we jumped back in the story about a week in time. And here we are bringing back to that night. So we just covered why Caiaphas had said that, of why he said better that one should die than this whole nation perish. So from Annas, they bring Jesus Christ to the house of Caiaphas. Caiaphas, again, was the high priest back then, at that year. Let's turn over to, if you can, Matthew chapter 26 and verse 57. Matthew 26 and verse 57. So they're going to have to come up with a way to convict Jesus Christ with a sin or a crime that would result in death. They wanted to kill him, right? But how do they do it? Chapter 26 and verse 57 says of Matthew, "And they that had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled." So this was the priest, the scribes, the whole council was there. This is different from the nighttime meeting with Annas. This is the whole Sanhedrin, the whole council. And what they did there was they tried to find a witness, tried to find somebody that could say that Christ sinned in this way or that. But they didn't find any. They had to fabricate some witnesses. Let's read now verse 56. It says, as Jesus is before this council, the Sanhedrin, "For many bear false witness against him, but their witnesses agreed not." If we keep on reading, we'll see what they were trying to convict him of. Verse 61, "Again, the high priest asked him and said unto him, Are you Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Are you..." What they were trying to do, he was trying to ask, "Are you the Son of God? Are you actually the Son of God? Are you so bold as to say that you are God?" And if you are, they were hoping to convict him of blasphemy. Notice it says, "Are you the Son of the Blessed?" They couldn't bring themselves to say the name of God. So they said that in a euphemistic term. "Do you believe that you are the Son of the Blessed? Do you believe you're the Son of God?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest rent his clothes and said, "What need we any further witnesses?" So Christ basically says, "I am." He doesn't use God's name, but he says, "I am that. And you are going to see this eventually." And then he says, "You have heard the blasphemy." That is the high priest. Caiaphas says that. "What think you?" And all of them condemned him to be guilty of death. Notice what the crime was here. They wanted to convict him of blasphemy. If it could be proved that this was a blasphemous man, it would be very useful for them. Remember, this was the religious authority that had sway over the religious scene of the day. The Pharisees, people looked to them to be the guides. And if they could prove that this religious figure that the people were following committed blasphemy, that would seriously undercut Christ's following. Christ, again, was extremely popular with the people, and they sought false witnesses to accuse him or to agree that he had committed blasphemy. They couldn't find him or anyone that agreed to that, or that the witnesses agreed, so they tried to get Christ himself to say it himself, that he was the Son of God. Nevertheless, even though they said that he is guilty of death and guilty of blasphemy, for whatever reason, the Jews don't put him to death. They sent him next to Pilate. But notice that they don't send him to Pilate with the case of blasphemy. What would Pilate care about blasphemy? He wouldn't. He only cares about if a Roman citizen's involved in a case, or if there's treason perpetrated by these people against the Roman Empire. That's what he cares about. So notice how the Jews approach this. This is in Luke chapter 23 and verse 1 and 2. Luke chapter 23 and verse 1 and 2. It says, and the whole multitude of them arose, so they came from where Caiaphas was, this whole Sanhedrin, and led him to Pilate, who was the procurator, the Roman official governing the territory of Judea, and they began to accuse him, saying, we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. So notice they've got no reason, no point of blasphemy here that wouldn't work on Pilate. So they have to make something up that he was saying, that Christ was saying, you shouldn't pay taxes to Caesar. Obviously, that's a lie. Christ did say that you should render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. But Pilate wasn't a dummy. He knew that the Jews were probably up to something. Verse 3, and Pilate asked him, saying, are you a king? Are you the king of the Jews? And he answered and said, you said it. Then said Pilate to the chief priests and to the people, I find no fault in this man. And they were more fierce, saying, he stirs up the people. He's teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place. He's stirring up the people to rebel. That's why we're bringing him to you. We're just your humble servants that want the Roman Empire to stay in power, which they do. But the only way that Pilate was going to kill this man was if he was proven to be a zealot, a thief, a robber. And according to Pilate, that wasn't the case. But notice something here. When Pilate hears the Jews say that he began in Galilee and also has been preaching this to this place, being Jerusalem. Verse 6, when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. He's smart. He sees the hatred that the Jews have for these people. He doesn't necessarily want to upset, sees the hatred that the Jews have for Jesus Christ, but he doesn't want to upset the Jews, because if he upsets the Jews too much, they might approach the Roman government. He might lose his position of power. So he doesn't really want to give a firm judgment on this. He hears them say that he's from Galilee, and he realizes, huh, well, here's my escape hatch. I can get out of this. Remember that the area of Galilee is still independent from Judea. It's ruled by Herod Antipas. So Pilate decides that Herod Antipas can deal with it. It's his jurisdiction. Verse 7 in Luke chapter 23, and as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod Antipas's jurisdiction, you could put in there, he sent him to Herod Antipas, who himself also was at Jerusalem at this time. Now, it's through tradition, obviously, for these leaders, including the procurator, to come to Jerusalem every year during Pesach or during the Days of Unleavened Bread. Because of the prophecies, the Jews knew that the Messiah was meant to come, according to their testimony, that he would come around this time, and that you would have Jews flood into Jerusalem from all over the world. So Pilate wanted to keep a lid on this, and he came to Jerusalem every year during the Passover. Herod Antipas, also being somewhat Jewish, he came as well. So he didn't need to send him all the way up to Galilee. He just sent him around the corner to where Herod Antipas was. Verse 8, and when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad he was desirous to see him for a long season, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. He questioned him, as it goes on to say, but Jesus Christ didn't say a word to Herod Antipas. He didn't have much respect for this man, for what he had done previously. He was responsible for John the Baptist's death, obviously. He was in an adulterous relationship with his brother's wife, and Jesus Christ didn't really say anything before Herod Antipas that we can tell. So they sent him back to Pilate. So from Herod Antipas, he goes back to Pilate. That escape hatch didn't work for Pilate. Jesus Christ comes back to him. Now we can read this. We'll just skip down a bit, I think, to verse 13. It says, and Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people, so again, he's assembling this Sanhedrin, he said unto them, you have brought this man unto me as one that perverts the people, as one that's causing insurrection. That's what you say. Behold, I've examined him even before you, and you have found no fault in this man touching these things which wherewith you accuse him of. No, nor yet Herod, the other leader up in the north. For I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him. Therefore I will chastise him, I'll scourge him, I'll whip him, but then let me release him. Because you guys remember, you have this tradition here that I can release one prisoner, whom you like, at the feast. Let it be this man. Look at the people. The people love this man, and he has no insurrection or treasonous desires against the Roman Empire. And they cried out all at once, away with this man, and release unto us Barabbas. Verse 19, who, this Barabbas, for a certain sedition made in the city and for murder, was cast into prison. Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, spoke to them again. But they cried, crucify him, crucify him. And he said unto them the third time, why? What evil has he done? I have found no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. This is the fourth time in this chapter that he's saying, I'm going to let him go. Can you believe this? The hypocrisy here behind the Jewish leadership, and just how brazen it is that they say, release unto us Barabbas, who was in prison for being a zealot. He was in prison for being convicted of murder, trying to overthrow the Roman government. And they're saying, no, let's release him, but keep Jesus and crucify him. And their claim against him was exactly what Barabbas had done. They were asking for condemnation of Jesus on the same grounds that Barabbas was convicted. Let's go over to John chapter 19 and verse 16 and 17. And here we see why Pilate folded, why he ended up going through with this. John chapter 19 and verse 16 and 17. It says, when the chief priests, therefore, and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, crucify him, crucify him. So this is just a different version of that history that we covered in the other gospel. But Pilate said unto them, take you him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him. So he said, you just go and do it. I'm not going to have the blood on my hands. I don't find him guilty. Then the Jews answered him, and they said, we have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God. Now notice, up to this point, there's been no mention of the case of blasphemy, or the case that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, brought before the procurator, Pontius Pilate. They had only said he was trying to cause insurrection, treason against the Roman Empire. That's why we've brought him before you. And finally, they come clean here and they say, well, we have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God, because he's committed blasphemy according to us. No man can be the Son of God. Then verse 8, when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was more afraid. The gloves had come off. This wasn't about treason. This wasn't about insurrection. It was about the Jews wanting Christ dead because of something in their law. Now, there was a law. Pilate couldn't do that. That wasn't, his jurisdiction didn't come into that area. He knew now that this treasonous case was completely fabricated. And the Jews were pretty much exposed to what they really wanted and why they wanted. They just wanted him dead, and they wanted Pilate to do it. Verse 9, and went, verse 9 here. I think this is in another gospel account. And it says, and they went again. I think this is John's account, I believe. Yeah, it's John's account. And they went again into the judgment hall and said unto Jesus, whence are you? But Jesus gave him no answer. Then said Pilate unto him, speak you not unto me? Know you not that I have the power to crucify you and have power to release you? And Jesus answered, you could have no power at all against me, except it was given from you from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto you has the greater sin. And from thenceforth Pilate sought to release him again. He was going to release him. He knew he wasn't guilty of this insurrection, but the Jews cried out saying, if you let this man go, Pontius Pilate, you are not Caesar's friend. and whosoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. Oh, they whipped it out. They whipped out the doozy on Pontius Pilate that got him extremely concerned, extremely worried. Verse 13, when Pilate therefore heard that saying, what saying? Saying that he wasn't Caesar's friend, he brought forth Jesus and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. And really, he gave in at that point. Now, he gave in when he heard that saying. That saying that they said that he wouldn't be classified as a loyal supporter of Caesar. This friend of Caesar, it's an honorific title that someone could be awarded in the realm. It was a formal claim of friendship, of pure submission in a way to Caesar. They weren't going to rebel. You've been known to be a friend of Caesar. We're going to stamp you with that saying. But when the Jews said, if you release this man, you're not a loyal supporter of Caesar, he finally gives in. Why was Pilate susceptible to this blackmail? Why did he care what the Jews said? If he was strong in his position of leadership over the Jewish state, or the Jewish territory here, he could have said, well, that's fine, you can say that, but he knows me. He knows that I'm his friend, and that he would believe me over you. But that's not what happened. The question is, if a report went to Rome, to Caesar himself, and the Jews said, you know, the leader that you've set up, he isn't convicting this man of treason. He isn't convicting these people that are trying to rebel against your government. Please remove him or get somebody else in here to do that. And what we see is Pilate was afraid of that happening. Why was he afraid? Well, there was a couple of occasions before this where Pilate had upset Caesar himself in the way that he was ruling. And this would have been strike three for him. Sure, if it was the first offense, Caesar might have believed Pilate over the Jews. But he had done a couple other things. When he first came into power in Judea, Pontius Pilate, when the armies of the Romans came in during the holy days to Jerusalem, they used to cover their standards, their eagles, to ensure that no idol would be seen in Jerusalem, to basically not upset the Jews. Now, prefects or procurators before Pontius Pilate had done this, they'd covered the standards, and they didn't upset the Jews. Pontius Pilate comes in and says, "Huh, I'm the ruler of these people, I can do what I want." Well, the Jewish delegation goes to Rome and tells Caesar, this is what happened, he's upsetting the Jews, you want order, he's not creating order. And Caesar said to Pontius Pilate, hey, next time you cover your standards. Then there was another time when Pilate needed to get some more water, or the Jews needed more water for the temple service. So he wanted to arrange an aqueduct, or build an aqueduct to bring more water into the city. And he thought, well, since I'm bringing water into the city for the Jews, I can use some of the temple treasury money, some of the Jews' money for that process. And that's what he did. Another Jewish delegation was sent to Rome to talk to Caesar, and Caesar again sides with the Jews. So with these two things in mind that the Jews obviously knew about, you can see why they feel at liberty to disrespect this Roman ruler. If they sent another complaint, they would undoubtedly be believed. And in essence, you know, that would have meant that Jesus or Pontius Pilate would have been removed from his own position of rulership, his own position of government as the procurator of Judea. So, he delivers Jesus Christ to be crucified. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 27 and verse 50. Just one final passage here before we conclude. Matthew chapter 27 and verse 50. Just get there myself. This is right after Christ is killed. He yields up the spirit, as it says there. And he said previous to that, it is finished. This job is done. And Pontius Pilate here, obviously threatened by his own job and his own desire to stay in power, delivered him up to be crucified. Verse 50 says, when Jesus cried again with a loud voice, he yielded up the spirit. Verse 51, and behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from top to the bottom. And again, this is probably about an hour ago, 2,000 years ago, if you know what I mean by that. The veil was rent from top to bottom, and the earth did quake, and rocks rent, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many. Now when the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake, as they're looking up at him still on the stake, as he just cried out in finally being killed, when they saw him, this centurion and those that were with him saw the earthquake, and they saw those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, truly, this was the Son of God. The centurion knew at this point, Pilate knew, the Jews knew, the people knew, and yet Christ, the Messiah, was dead. And as going through this history, we see nothing about that trial that was right, just, even by the standards of both the Roman government or the government of the Jews. And yet this is what our Savior subjected himself completely. Now, I hope by understanding a little bit more of the backstory behind the gospel account, that this history has become more alive. These are real people, real characters, real events. And they happened in the context of the world that they lived in, a world that, you know, is like ours in a way. These were real events. And as you go through your study of the Gospels, think of the context of these events. They were real happenings, just like the Bible says happened. You've been listening today to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and we were coming live to you from Edstone in England. Have a wonderful weekend, and tonight, a wonderful night to be much observed.